You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Pacifica Station KPFK's Jennifer Balsesto visited a mosque over the weekend and spoke with several attendees about their faith and the concerns they have with the Bush administration pursuing a second war against Iraq. She presents now this first of a multi-part series documenting the Iraqi-American community of Southern California.
Last Friday night, I pulled up to the Alil Bet Mosque, a modest community building in Pomona, California. There are about a quarter million Americans of Iraqi descent. Nearly 30,000 of them live in Southern California, and many of them have settled in Pomona, a city of 150,000 people located 30 miles east of Los Angeles. I sat down with five Iraqi men before their Ramadan services started. Ramadan is the month of fasting where Muslims cannot drink or eat during daylight hours. It is also believed that it was during this month that the Holy Scriptures for Muslims, the Quran, was brought to the people.
We pray in the holy month of Ramadan and God may respond.
Mr. Bassam al-Husani, spokesperson for the Al-Bahed Mosque.
So we pray for the safety of the Iraqi people. We pray for the regime to be removed and so the Iraqi people will stop the ongoing suffering. So this is one of the things that we always pray. We pray every night. As a matter of fact, each and every night that we gather afterwards at the end of the program, we stay to rescue the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people will live in a peace just like any other nation. I have family live in Iraq. I have a mom and four sisters, and I have two brothers. They've been arrested. They've been in Iraqi prisons since 1980. They've been accused, they did not want to join the Ba'ath Party. That's the government party. It's over there, it's required. It's either you go join the Ba'ath Party or you disappear, or you get arrested. They got arrested in 1980. They've been in prison for the last 22 years. We have not heard a thing about them. We don't know what happened to them. My father suffered a great deal of depression, and he passed away because the stress that he had to live as a result of aftermath of my two brothers' arrest. And when I talk to them, especially nowadays, well, they're waiting for another war, another bomb to be dropped in their heads.
Unfortunately, I was driving over here and I was thinking how long it is since I've seen my cousins.
Mohammad Hakak.
We were little kids. I was in sixth grade. I was 12 years old and I haven't seen my cousins since 78. And we've gone our whole life, we haven't spent our cousins. What would we talk about? What would we do? There's a lot of things that you miss and you've forgotten about it because you hear people at work or people who you work with, they say, oh, we're going with my cousin's house. And I miss that. And sometimes you forget we have a lot of Arabic. We're a very close community. But it's still nothing like a cousin or an uncle or a grandparents that you could go visit in the holiday time. And you don't have that. And you kind of miss it. And you call them up. And you, every once in a while, somebody has cancer. You hear them. They have cancer that could be cured. But there's no medicine. We can't cure them. We have people that go back. They have to smuggle in medicine for tablets to cure this small little cure that takes a tablet. But these sanctions are still there. They're never going to end. They've gone and destroyed all these weapons. Every time there's money from this oil for food, the United States vetoes one of these money that goes to Iraq, and it's over $2 or $5 billion, I've heard on the radio, that America will not release to these Iraqi people. This is money of oil they should have for medicine and food. And every time at the United Nations, United States of America vetoes because they say, I was hearing to report, they don't even let them have yogurt machine because they're afraid that's going to make nuclear weapons. It's ridiculous. And when does it end?
I think there are a lot of hidden agenda.
Salim al-Jawad.
We're hoping that this hidden agenda is not really something that will destroy the country again. And this is what we pray to God, that this is not going to happen again. Not because we want Saddam to stay. On the contrary, I can say that if not 100%, almost like 99.999% of the Iraqi people want Saddam to go out, but not in the form of another destruction. So the United States, if they have a plan, we would like to hear the plan. We would like to hear what is it that they are interested in implementing in Iraq. If they are interested in the oil, well, the oil is there. Nobody's going to drink it. But we don't want another occupation. We don't want the American or the rest of the world, for that matter, to come and impose another dictator and then start another era of another problems for the next 20 years. And this is what we don't want to see. We would like to see a form of democratic government in Iraq. I believe the Iraqi people are well capable of ruling themselves if they are given the chance.
With regards to whether the Iraqi American community, do we feel safe talking about, you know, the deaths, the possible war?
Zaid Hakak.
I mean, as an attorney, I do not feel safe. I mean, the FBI running observations, civil liberties of us American citizens, Iraqi American citizens, being just, you know, flushed down the toilet with regards to some of the rulings and some of the areas that the FBI is wandering into, it causes me to be concerned. I mean, well, yes, the FBI has voluntary questioning of Iraqi Americans. What is voluntary questioning? If I have done nothing wrong but beside my nationality, I mean, where does that stop? Yeah, I'm fearful of it. I mean, I hope everybody else would be fearful of it too, because, I mean, yes, we're concerned about the people over there, but we also want to be concerned about our well-being here and our freedoms here.
My name is Sayyid Murtada. My last name Al-Qazwini. I am Iraqi. I was born in Karbala. I am a religious man, you know, a religious leader. Yes, I came to United States at, I think 17 years ago. I escaped from Iraq because Saddam Hussein, he is against all the religious men. And he killed 15 of my family members. He killed my father. When they captured him, he was about 80 years old. And they put him in the jail. And then we have no any news from him. I think during 4 or 5 years after that, I think he died or they killed him, I don't know. They killed 3 of my nephews, okay? I mean my sister's son. They killed them. And then my sister also, she died after they killed her son. 15 of my family members, they've been killed in Iraq. So Iraq is, you know, Saddam is a dictator. He's against everybody. He doesn't need any forgiveness. Okay? He hates everybody. The situation is in Iraq is very bad, as you know. You know, I have 2 sisters in Iraq. I had 3 ones. One of them, as I told you, she died because they killed 3 of her sons. Now I have 2 sisters in Baghdad. Their situation is very bad. All our families, all the people, Iraqi people, who do not support Saddam, all of them, their situation is very bad. They have no food to eat, no medicine, no freedom, no democracy. So we need democracy and freedom in Iraq.
I'm originally from Iraq, but I'm American citizen here. I've been here for over 30 years. Yes, my family is in Iraq. All my family is there, and I'm worried about them. Really, and I sometimes hear a lot of things about them. The kids are really hysterical about bombing. They were sending me messages and say, please tell Mr. Bush not to bomb. Because, you know, please tell them, all the children are begging you not to bomb us. See, the problem is when you bomb, you don't bomb Saddam. You bomb, you know, the people are. They went through a lot through the Gulf War. And now they think, you know, this is it. If something going to happen, they're going to bomb again. That's going to be really the end of their life. That's what they're going to think. You know, they are thinking that way. So So I'm praying to God, you know, not to hurt the people, you know. So really, I don't want them to bomb.
You know, we Iraqi people, we are Muslim. You know, we believe in Islam. We believe in Allah, God. We believe in the Holy Quran. We fast Ramadan, as you know. And during this month, Ramadan, we fast. We do not eat, we do not drink during the day, okay? And then in the time of sunset, at 5 o'clock, we eat, we break our fast. And we come to our masjid, mosque, we pray, we recite Quran. Now my friend is reciting Quran, this as usual. And then I make a speech for them in their language, in Arabic, okay? It is our culture. And we need our children, our brothers, have you know, freedom. We teach them according to our religion, our belief. It is our culture.
أنا ال قلت لكم الكلمات المختلفة شو هي التعب صاحب الملوك.
During the Ramadan services, upstairs in the mosque, the children take Arabic classes.
أشعر بالتعب. عكس كلمة التعب شو هي؟ لما واحد يرتاح يشعر بشنو؟ زهرة.
My name is Fatima Jaffer, and I'm 13 years old. I come from Karbala, and it's from the south of Iraq. I'm proud of being it, and you know, I talk to my friends a lot about it when it comes up in my classrooms, in my history class. We just discuss of how we really feel about it, and I really don't want a war between America and Iraq, even though I don't like Saddam Hussein. It's just that my family and relatives all live there, and I don't want to see them getting killed, and innocent people will get killed, and you know, that's not fair because they haven't done anything bad.
My name is Ali Alakar, and I'm 12 years old. I would like to visit Iraq, but I don't think I'll be able to in the near future. It's kind of scary because maybe like one of my relatives' building will get hit and then they'll die, and I don't want that to happen.
My name's Hannah Saeed, and I'm 12 years old. My grandma and my uncles and aunts, I talk to them on the phone and stuff, but it's like well, I've never seen them, so they just don't have everything that we have. We're like so rich and uppity, and you know, like back there, they don't have like practically anything. Like, they used to have water that was like, you know, not very good, and so like I don't think they have a very good lifestyle because of the bombings and stuff like that. I think that they're probably afraid because they don't want to get killed. I mean, who does?
This is Jennifer Basesto reporting for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
Jennifer Basesto produced that report at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles with help from Peace Watch producer Dan Pavlish. Stay tuned for the second part of the documentary next week on Peace Watch. A recent article by columnist Sean Gonsalves advocating nonviolence as an effective tool to address current world issues appeared in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Gonsalves asserts that our schools fail to teach students the effectiveness of nonviolence and that the detractors of nonviolence are uninformed. Is it effective? Is it relevant to the issues that we face today? How can we pass these principles on to another generation? Reporter, commentator, Sean Gonsalves.
The problem with nonviolence is that it doesn't take evil seriously, or it doesn't. And, you know, I think anyone even vaguely familiar with the lives of Dr. King or Gandhi, but these are people that we're talking about who are honored and admired precisely because of their courage in facing evil and developed huge spiritual muscles. But they're ordinary people who showed a way that human beings can respond evil.
I was just going to say that I could imagine critics and people who are not students of nonviolence might counter by saying, yes, well, Jesus and Gandhi and Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., they're dead as a result of their stance. And perhaps that's what they mean by the fact that they say the nonviolence doesn't take evil into account fully.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, they are dead and paid the ultimate price. But I believe, though, there's about a billion followers of Jesus now, you know, across the world, or at least people who claim to follow him. And, you know, for people like Hitler, there's far less numbers of those people who who have bought into that mindset, although those people do exist. You know, my contention is that not always, you know, when the ultimate sacrifice is paid, are the result, the rewards of that sacrifice immediately apparent, particularly to the person who made the sacrifice. But I think it also points to a flaw in maybe some of the leadership models where you have this cult of personality where Dr. King becomes the movement, Gandhi becomes the movement. Now, those people are charismatic figures, and maybe to inspire people, you need symbolic figures like that. But on the other hand, there is another idea where you know, how about, you know, I've suggested before, how about training an army of Gandhis, an army of Dr. Kings? Mm-hmm. So to the extent that we think that these people are just these divine beings who are extraordinary in ways that are impossible for average, ordinary people to reach, both Gandhi and King said often that they're ordinary people who have allowed themselves to develop in certain ways and who have committed themselves to something that ordinary people can do. And when you look at nonviolent struggles in different parts of the world, you know, you're talking about movements that require the participation and the commitment of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, ordinary people, not saints, not angelic beings. You know, say South Africa, that was a struggle that involved nonviolent movements and nonviolent change. But then people point to the violence that often surrounds nonviolent movements, but that's precisely it. Nonviolent theory and practice does not think that, well, if we take these particular strategies and tactics, there's going to be no violence. In fact, nonviolence starts with the assumption that when you challenge through civil disobedience the authority of a power elite, the predictable response is that they're going to respond with violence, and that the very power of violence is the people's capacity to suffer.
Are you teaching this method, this pacifist teaching, or is this just something that you choose to write about
in your column
from time to time?
It's something that I choose to write about. I don't teach it. It's something that I've been studying for a number of years, and I don't consider myself a pacifist, by the way. I think there's a difference between nonviolent theory and practice and pacifism. Pacifism is the idea that violence, as a response to anything, that violence in all circumstances and in all cases is inappropriate and unjustified. I'm not going so far as to say that.
Those in the audience who may be seeking to use nonviolence as a tool, the contemporary challenge would be this impending war against Iraq. Mm-hmm. How would nonviolence how might that be used in this scenario to affect the type of change that anyone would be interested in effecting?
I think, number one, you have to begin with the assumption that even Iraqis, even Arabs are human beings with similar human aspirations that we have. I can tell you that despite the emphasis on our differences, there is a common humanity that we share the globe over. And if you begin with that common humanity, you begin to recognize that a lot of this, the anger, the resentment, stems from unjust and oppressive and terrible policies. So a nonviolent approach would take into account these things and say, look, one thing that would alleviate a lot of the tension that helps to cultivate these sick minds that would engage in terrorism and these kind of things comes from an honest accounting of some of the policies and the effects that they have. The sanctions need to be lifted immediately, number one, to look at this thing candidly and to say, is it fair to hold hostage civilians, innocent civilians, who have very little power to overthrow a dictator, to force them to suffer because of the actions of this one man?
Now, you write in your article, The Future of Peace, Let Students Know Nonviolence Works, that when it comes to peace, there are only two relevant questions. Peace under what terms, and how do we get there from here?
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to that?
I think that's right on the money, because we got to be very careful, as George Orwell warned us of the language that we use and how it's used. And my point was simply that, look, everybody wants peace. You talk to anybody, everybody wants peace. I think even though some people took this the wrong way, when I said that even Hitler wanted peace, what I don't mean is that, I don't mean to say that Hitler was a peaceful man. What I mean to say is that Hitler wanted peace. So you ask the question, peace under what terms? Well, under the terms that there will be peace as long as there's no Jews in the world, or there's only Aryans, or something along those lines. So that's why the crucial question is always peace under what terms? Look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So, and then you go to this, what they call the generous Barak offer, where he offered 95% of the West Bank. On the one level, why would the Palestinians reject that? That's such a lot, you know, it's almost everything. Well, the question, of course, what does the other 5% mean? If you're giving somebody 95% of land that you can't use, that doesn't have water, that doesn't have stuff that you can plant on, that's and the other 5% is where the water resources are and all these other kind of things, then those are not just terms. Sure, peace, but under what terms, and then how do we get there from here? Who's going to bear the who's going to shoulder the burdens for the cost of that peace? And whose shoulders is it going to disproportionately fall on? So even though it's a slogan, no justice, no peace, I think there's a lot of truth to that. There cannot be peace. Peace cannot be separated from justice.
Commentator Sean Gonsalves, he says the most celebrated practitioners of peacemaking are famous precisely because they stared human wickedness dead in the face and moved forward with a courage even the bravest of the brave must admire. Finally today, we present this anti-war musical mix from Skidmark Bob and Pop Defect Radio. There are demonstrations taking place all over this nation and indeed around the world. The pledge to resist.
It would have been good for you to be here, George, so you could see what America really looks like. But we are the real America. We are the patriots that believe that America should heal the world and not bring the world to nuclear war over the interests of those business tycoons who put you in the White House.
Let's talk about money. $40 billion. That's how much money the U.S. spends on children's health care. The next is how much the U.S. spends on K-12 education, about $30 billion. The next line is how much we spend on higher education, about $15 billion. The next line is job training, $8 billion. The next line is affordable housing, $30 billion. The next line is environmental protection, $8 billion. And the next line, the one that they are pulling out right now, is how much the U.S. spends on the Pentagon budget. And that equals $355 billion every year. And it's on a ribbon because that line goes off the chart.
Tell the Congress and all the world, they didn't vote for me when they voted to carry out a war against the people of Iraq.
And an attack on Iraq will be genocide again. It has to be prevented.
You talk about a regime change, George Bush, but let me tell you, we want a regime change on Pennsylvania Avenue.
I come to you with the greetings of the people of Basra and Baghdad, the greetings of the camps of Palestine, the people who look to you to stop the bombs that have been coming to them, killing them. You today are making the history. You are entering history in its widest gates.
I dream of the day when the power of love replaces the power of might. That will be the day when our world will know the blessings of peace.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. In our name, will you wage endless war? There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name, will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names, will you evolve the very feet. freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real.
That creative expression from Skidmark Bob and Pop Defect Radio.
The general said, "You're young, I guess you don't understand. Gotta have these things in case it gets out of hand." I said, "What if they're just like you? Always got to be on top. Isn't there some place to end this? Isn't there some place to stop? What if everyone thought like you?" The general said to me, "Oh, what a vulnerable country. What if everyone thought like you?" The general said to me, I said, "There would be some peace. There just might be some peace. Oh, there just might be some peace. There just might be some peace. Oh, there just might be some peace. There just might be some peace."
Daryl Cherney, Stop the War. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Copies of the program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at PacificaArchives.org. Or calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm the executive producer, Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the holidays.